Like to welcome everybody to the webinar on hypnoepigenetics. And the only difference is, of course, on Facebook Live, you're only going to see me. If you go to my website later or ask for it, it'll be in a different site. I'll also have my the PowerPoint that I use with it. And so that's always a lot of fun. If you want to watch the PowerPoint, I can't. It's too much. It's awful hard to do that on Facebook Live, but you'll hear me talk about it. So if you decide you want the PowerPoint, or if you just see it here and you want it, I'll post the PowerPoint underneath the thing as we get going. So hypnoepigenetics. Again, follow me for more. If you like this, go to nfnlp.com. If you're not on my mailing list, get on my mailing list. I do e-zines with articles and videos and stuff like that. Also, follow me on Twitter at Dr. Will at RealNLP. And Instagram at Dr. Will Horton, and of course here on Facebook Live. Follow me, watch this, it's a lot of fun. So what is epigenetics? First of all, when we talk about epigenetics, I wanna first start with what it really is, because unfortunately, to be honest with you, in the field I bounce between psychology, alcohol and drug counseling, and the hypnosis NLP world. Sometimes I see the hypnosis in the NLP world co-opt a technical term and kind of co-opt it. And then what they do is they what they're talking about isn't what the scientific community is really what they're talking about. And I see this with neuroplasticity. I see this with neuroplasticity. I see it with some of the neurobiology, epigenetics, and all these things. So we're going to talk about, first, what is epigenetics? Well, it's a study in the changes of organism caused by the modification of gene expression rather than the alteration of the genetic code itself, right? So it's the alterations in how the codes are expressed, right? And what happens is epigenetic modifications, they can be reversed because that makes the genome, where your genes are, flexible. So they can respond to environment such as nutrition, stress, toxicity, exercise, right? It's why our brains are so neuroplasticity pliable, because it's in your epigenetics, your genes change, right? We all go through these kind of things. But let me tell you, here's a good example of it. Rats usually don't run from the smell of fruit, right? They would run toward it. But one of the great things psychologists are good at are torturing rats and graduate students, right? So what they did is they took some rats and they paired a scent, basically a fruit scent, orange, cherry, almond. I can't pronounce the word. And they paired it, that scent of the fruit, with an electric shock. And the rats quickly learned to run from it, right? Because I did a thing on habits. If you want, email me, I'll send you the thing on habits. And basically what happens when you learn a habit, you study, your brain's very active when you're learning. Then as soon as it's a habit, once it starts, your brain goes to sleep and you can do other things. Like when you drive a car, when you first learned, it took all your concentration. Now you're talking on the phone, even though you're not supposed to, you're texting, you're eating a sandwich, whatever, right? So that's what happened with these rats. Their brains learned it. Now along the way, because now we can measure it, they had extra neurons grow in their noses and in the smell processing centers of the brains that linked them to that scent. So when they had that odor, that scent in the air, they went into fear response and would run away. And it was a self-survival mechanism, right? Because your whole brain is, your only job in life is to stay alive and pass on your genes. That's what we're trying to do, right? So what's surprising, really surprising about this study is that the rat's pups, you know, by the father, also were startled by the smell and had the same neurons in their nose and in their brains as their dads, despite the fact they never met their dads. Their dads had nothing to do with it. And they were never exposed to that scent before, right? So it turns out that instilling their fear in the rats, Trinetter did change the genetic code, but not in the DNA itself. And it's how the DNA was read and used in the rats' bodies. This is fascinating because it has uses for us. Because what happens is there's chemical switches that in our DNA that turns gene on and off, It tells your genes what proteins to make. Really, all you are is a huge protein-generating machine, and the proteins express themselves as your behavior, how you look, how you act, all this stuff, right? And we all go through these things when genes turn on and off. Most of us can relate. When you went into puberty, one day you seem like a little kid, the next day something happened, there was a genetic switch, and suddenly you started growing hair where there wasn't hair before. Maybe you had a growth spurt, you got muscle, if you were a male, you changed your taste. Things changed like that. The genes were turned on and you went down a different path, right? These are called epigenetic tags. And it's also why, like when it happens, when you're forming a kidney cell, a stem cell turns into a kidney cell, another stem cell turns into another stem cell, another stem cell will turn into a nerve or whatever. It's cool stuff, right? And again, this is what happens. There's some kind of thing in your environment or something triggers this for this epigenetic tag to go off, right? And there's some studies now about like why are kids going into puberty earlier than ever before? Is it the hormones in the milk? We're always looking for a simple answer. Hey, Ms. Mezzer, say hi, click like and share. So what happened is, kids going into puberty. Is it like we said, the hormones in the meat and the milk and chemicals and all that? Maybe that's part of it. Maybe that sets it off. Maybe it's the fact we have a highly sexualized world where it's all about just survival. So maybe that could be a lot of things, but we don't know, all these switches, they're not set in stone, right? But what happened with these rats is the smell sensing gene got thrown into overdrive and it was passed on to their offspring for survival, because now the male passing it on for survival. What's interesting is that when you were formed in your mother's womb, the egg that generated you was formed in your mother when she was in your grandmother's womb, all right? And actually, some of that goes back to your great-grandmother. When she was in the womb, certain things were forming that was going to get passed on, right? So, like, in my case, I'm like a 100-year-old egg, right? Just kind of interesting stuff. So what we want to do is Think about that, right? And so, but in the men, our genetic code, parts of it are a little bit more flexible. So seemed like that male rat, it was passed through his sperm cells. That what was altered in the male rat, so it got passed on to the offspring. So researchers don't know all the places in the rat's genetic code that get turned on or off, but it just proves that these things happen, right? And it's measurable. And this is what's so cool. So we've been able to connect some of these things in mice. Unfortunately, we can't make all these links, contrary to what a lot of the people that are really pushing some of this stuff with humans, because unlike rats, whose lifespan is short, highly controllable, humans aren't, right? So, but we are learning more and more all the time. This is what gets so exciting. Because your thoughts can cause a gene to be expressed or inhibited. In other words, turned on or off, right? In rodents, where the experiments can be controlled, not just observed, we've shown the behavior in the brain and the body. And then we can actually, study their genetic genome and look at what actually changed and things like this. So, and what turns on and off genes in like rats and monkeys will also work on humans. There was another study done. What they did is with rats, they know that female rats, much like humans, the parenting instinct in a female rat falls on a continuum from like the baby's born, the pup is born, they're licked all the time, they're nurtured, they're cozed, they're constantly, fussed over, all the way to the rats that basically let their pups die, right? But there's a whole continuum. So what they did is they took some genetic clones. So the rats were genetically identical, and then when the rats were born, they took them from the birth mother and put them with, surrogate rats. But some of the rats were nurturing. Other rats, not so much. But the rats that were highly nurturing, starting from the instant they were born, they were licked and cuddled and taken care of. And the rats that weren't, they had some different, they turned out to be different rats, even though they were genetically identical. The rats that were nurtured, licked, and really, especially in those first few moments of birth, you know, they grow brown, they were healthy, they live longer, they weren't obese, yada, yada, yada. The rats that weren't genetically identical were yellow, sickly, ended up being obese with diabetes, all these other health issues. Interesting stuff, right? So it was the nurturing right after that maybe turned on these genes, right? And also the rats that were highly nurtured were much more group oriented. They wanted to be part of the group. They had empathy with other rats, if you want to say that, as opposed to the rats that survived that weren't very nurtured. They were not very social, right? So does this have applications for humans? Yes, it's kind of unethical to really do the study we need, but yes, it does, right? So this leads me to a couple of one old story. We're going to update it based with the new technology. A lot of us in this world talk about the basketball study. And what I mean by that is they took some people and they taught them how to shoot a basket. They taught them to shoot a basket. And then they had them practice every day. I think it was like 10 or 15 minutes, but physically shooting a basket. Great. Then they took a group, taught them how to shot a basket. Great. And then said, come in every day for 10 or 15 minutes. You're going to visualize shooting the basket. Great. Right. And then they took a group and basically did nothing, right? Taught them to shoot, but they didn't have to do anything, right? Anyway, on the follow-up, of course, the group that actually practiced, let's say they started shooting 7 out of 10. But the group that didn't actually physically practice but mentally practice shot 6 out of 10, right? So it was almost as good without the physical activity, right? And then someone did the study later and actually had the person, another group, shoot every day for 10 minutes, then practice every day, correcting the errors in the real time. So instead of shooting 7 out of 10 in their brain, they hit every basket. And then, of course, on a follow-up, they shot like 9 out of 10. So that was a cool study. We use it a lot to talk about visualization and all this stuff. Now, we can update this with a really cool one done with brain imaging. And this really gets to epigenetics and neuroplasticity. They took some people and they taught them a one-handed piano exercise, right? And they said, well, come in every day for 2 hours a day, you'll practice this. Now, when they first learned it, they were wiring their brain. And of course, there's new circuits being fired, which you would expect. You're learning something new, so your brain is forming. Cool stuff, right? So we knew that. So again, the group that came in, and then they were, after they learned it, they would come in every day and practice for like 2 hours a day, physically practice. And of course, those brain patterns that were first learned are like almost like hardened because, as they say in neuroplasticity, neurons that fire together, wire together, it created a pathway, right? Great. Then they had a group come in, learn it. So they picked it, same thing in the brain. But then they would come in and mentally visualize playing it without physically playing it for about 2 hours, right? Keeping them on track, keeping them focused. Great stuff. And then on a follow-up, their brains were almost the same as the brains of that. And then, of course, they took a group. They did nothing. They just learned it, so they had the first learning, but they never did anything with it. A week or two later, it was almost gone, right? So this really shows our brains are pliable and learning, right? And this is neuroplasticity in action. Your brain doesn't know the difference in a real or vividly imagined event. This is pretty cool stuff. So again, and then there's been other studies where, you know, like if you lift weights, your muscles are being stimulated. If you vividly imagine lifting weights and put your attention on your muscle, you'll get the same thing, you know, which has led some of the higher end personal trainers that only want to train you when you can really focus on the exercise that you're doing. You know, if you're watching, you know, the news channel as you're like doing an exercise on a machine or you're singing along with the music, your brain's not engaged. It's not as effective. Because your brain doesn't know the difference between real or vividly imagined event, right? So, you know, for those on Facebook, you can't see it, but I have two pictures of a Monet painting, one earlier in his career, one later. And as he got later in his career, the pictures were more like fuzzy looking, right? And so people look at it and go, those are pretty pictures. But, you know, you just make a judgment, right? But now, what if I told you that Monet painting, when Monet, you know, he spent his whole life studying light, not just painting, but light. He said how light hits things, changes everything. The light in the morning, the light in the evening. And as he got older, he got cataracts, right? Which changes how you perceive things. So things got fuzzy. If you ever known anybody with cataracts, they tell you things start getting fuzzy. Well, you know, he was approached by doctors and said, we could fix this. We could fix this. Let's get the surgery. And he actually said, why would I want to fix this? I spent 40 to 50 years learning how to see this way. I'm going to paint what I see, right? Now, when you learn that, and then you go back and look at the painting, it changes how you perceive it. And when you change how you perceive it, it changes how it fires in your brain, right? And this really gets to what we talk about with epigenetics, right? Learning changes the perception, right? And there was a guy named Charles Hennell who wrote The Magic Key, one of the first true guys with like new thought stuff. He said, you can't have a new belief, which are thoughts repeating over and over, until you have a corresponding brain cell, right? So once you learn something new, if you repeat it, it becomes a pathway, then you can build on it, right? And our brain in humans, we know our thoughts can affect our physical bodies because, again, our brains don't know the difference between a real or vividly imagined event, which lead us to, can our thoughts make us sick? Can our thoughts make us older than, faster than normal? Can our thoughts make us tired? And if that's true, can our thoughts heal us from this illness? Can our thoughts make us delay aging? Can our thoughts give us energy when maybe we shouldn't have energy? We all know that's true. And now we're figuring out why. And a lot of this has to do with the epigenetics, you know? And again, what have I learned in my 35 years of studying addictions? When I look at people who have recovered from an addiction, they do some very specific things that people that don't recover from an addiction do, right? And guess what? Those same few markers, if you will, are the same for people that want to have a health change, you know, overcome a chronic illness or an injury, something like that. Or they want to have a prosperity change. They want to make money. They want to change their financial outlook, right? Or a relationship change. The people that change do a few things the same as opposed to those that don't, right? And first of all, they accept responsibility for where they are. And responsibility just means you have the ability to respond differently. So the people that, like, we'll use addiction, they go, I'm here where I'm at right now. And it's not about blame, it's things like that. And usually people that really recover from, especially a health issue or a financial issue, they accept responsibility for where they are, right? And it's not that maybe whatever happened, but they accept it. And a lot of people kind of do an inventory of, this is where I am, and I don't want to be here, and I need to change. And then they accept that there's an intelligence, like a higher power, if you will, that can help them. You know, whether it's the intelligence that beats your heart, you know, 100,000 times a day, billion times in a lifetime, pumps thousands and thousands of gallons of blood a day without you thinking about it. Digests food, which is, you know, there's like hundreds of thousands of chemical reactions that have to happen in your stomach and then your intestines to grab the food. Yeah, you can't think about that. There's an intelligence, if you will, even if it's just in your genetic code, that keeps you alive, right? So they accept responsibility. They kind of have an inventory of where they are. They want to change. They're willing to change. They know that there's an intelligence that can help them. And they reinvent who they are. In the recovery world, we always used to say, the same man drinks again. I don't hear that like I used to. Because they understood that a new personality creates a new personal reality. You can't really create a new world and be the old you. You can't work, you know, it's like, you know, it's like the people say, I moved, but I brought me with me, you know? So you have to create a new personality if you want to change. And also the people that really recover, whether, again, it's an addiction or a health or anything, they have a constant vigilance to this new you. They want to stay this new you, right? If not, it's a temporary increase of whatever it is they want, whether it's health or sobriety or money. And this is where you see people, like, win the lotto, but then they're broke 3 years later, right? And you're like, well, how'd that happen? Well, they weren't vigilant. This wasn't the new them, the rich them. They're still living like the poor person, right? Or they recover from an illness, they get a surgery, they get a pill, they get something, they get better, and then they relapse because they didn't change who they are. They didn't put the disease into the old person or the poverty or whatever it is that they're doing. And then usually the people that really recover start having new models and new associates. They have different models and different people they start hanging around with. in the addiction world, they always say, you know, you got to have new playmates and playpens. But this is true. If you start, if you're poor and you're around poor people, don't study poorness, study richness. And then when you start getting rich, hang around with rich people, you know, because then that becomes the norm. You may not all, as I say, you may not always rise to the level of your dreams. You will always fall to the level of your associates, right? So you get, they make those changes. So here's what happens for most people. When they get up in the morning, they have the same thoughts. They pull the thoughts from their past. So then what happens, they're thinking about what happened yesterday. Oh my God, I got to work with Joe again and this and that. So they're taking their past. They're first waking up, and I'll explain why. And they're overlaying it on the future and today, right? And then they use current situations to keep the old life alive, the fear, the hate, the resentments. You know, they use their hatred, right? And then they look for reasons to be hateful. They look for reasons to be fearful, to keep their illness, to keep whatever it is, right? Because that's the old life. And if they didn't feel these things, they wouldn't know what to feel, right? Most people cannot, especially people that can't handle change, they can't handle contentment, because contentment is just, I'm okay, right? And so they'll go, no, I'm supposed to be pissed off. You know, it's 8:30. I usually driving to work by now, and I'm mad at the world because of the traffic, whatever it is, right? So they get up, they draw from the past, they take the past, put it on the future. Then they do the same activities with the same people, so there's no epigenetic change. You start living what you would call a genetic destiny. Those things kick in, and you just keep repeating it, right? And yet some of the people expect a miracle, but nothing changes, because, you know, what's the other saying? If nothing changes, nothing changes. You got to make some changes. And usually, most of us, me included, all of you, you only make a change when you're kicked in the ass. Let's be honest. When there's an addiction or an illness or a loss, right? Then you're ready to make a change. And so brain scans of a guy wrote a brilliant book, and I listen to it and watch all his YouTubes. About, he's done like 80 something thousand brain scans. And there's a whole different talk. We could talk about why psychology and psychiatry is the only medical profession that don't use those kind of tests like brain scans to see what they're treating. They'll just use symptoms. But brain scans prove that you can heal the brain, you know? And again, like when we did this, we talked about the piano study a moment ago. Your brain's actually changed. When they had you wired up on the CAT scan and all that, your brain actually changed. It grew. It changed. It morphed, right? And we also know that things like meditation changes your brain, right? Because they know that if you relax and you put your attention, if you want to call it meditation, in the relaxed state, and you focus your attention on certain body parts or brain section, you actually increase the blood flow and the electrical activity. Right. So if you're doing it, like if you're you're in meditation or hypnosis, you can make your hand feel cold or hot. We all know that if you're a hypnotist, it's really cool stuff. But you can also increase or slow down things in your brain. Right. And then they also know that brain scans of long-term meditators, guys have been meditating 40 years, have happy brains. There's no other word to describe it. The part of their brain that would be lit up, and most of us were happy, I think it's on the left side, about the middle. It's bigger than people that meditate, right? Also, people that meditate have longer attention spans. Most of us, our attention span is, you know, maybe 15 seconds, right? And so to really meditate, you got to learn how to focus on that. We have short attention spans, right? So we know that with brain scans, we can actually alter our brains, which is epigenetics in action. But many of us have issues developing deep meditation due to our short attention span. And it's hard to think the thought and be the thinker, as I say, right? And learning opens up new neural pathways. That's what happened with the piano exercise. Neural pathways get opened. Even if something is quick, we talk about the Monet painting. If you didn't know that about Monet, it changes how you view Monet. You know, just like when somebody's being a complete, like they're in a bad mood and they're screaming at people and you're like, what a terrible person. Then you find out, oh, you know, there was a horrible accident and everybody in their family's dead or something. You're like, it changes your perception of it, right? Which changes your neural pathways. And then what happens, you have to be able to prune old pathways to to let them die. Because once you learn a behavior, you, it really doesn't ever totally extinguish in your brain. Your brain hangs onto it in case it needs it in the future to stay alive, right? It's why most of us could jump on a bike. Even if you haven't been on a bicycle in years, you could ride a bike. You might be a little shaky, you could ride a bike. You haven't driven a stick shift, you could still drive a stick shift. Why? Because your brain hung onto that activity because you might need it someday. And unfortunately, this is true of an addiction, dysfunctional relationship, not being good with money, health issues. Your brain will hang on to it, right? So again, what you have to do is be able to prune those pathways. They kind of go away. They never totally extinguish, but you have to be vigilant when they start coming back, right? And of course, the easiest way for most people to really do this is to get out of the self, to do things for other people, to become more selfless than selfish, right? When that happens, magic begins to happen, right? And what we know now, hypnosis and NLP allows us to skip ahead and get the same results as guided meditation does that takes people years to get to, we can get to in just a few sessions because we understand what it is. I love a couple of people talking about this isn't hypnosis, it's a long guided meditation. And yet then they're guiding you, which is hypnosis. Because through meditation, you're guiding your own meditation. There's a difference, right? And we also know, if you know how, you can anchor in those deeper states so you can get there quicker. That might take a meditator years, you can do it a matter of sessions, right? But then we also know that if you use images, and people who've taken my classes have seen me start to do this, I'm constantly putting pictures of brains, right? Or body parts that, you know, to guide your attention and your energy. Because again, you know, we've done it in hypnosis where you get a person to put their focus on their hand, they can make it feel hot or cold, and it'll actually change the physical temperature of the hand, right? Change the electrical currents. We can do it in the brain. So if you want to reprogram your brain, you picture what part of your brain you need to program. So if I wanted to work on my memory, I would picture the hippocampus down in there. It's about the middle of the brain, between the forebrain and the midbrain, and kind of imagine it growing and whatever I'm trying to remember to become long-term, right? And if I actually practice it, guess what? Those parts of my brain lights up. It's just the way it is, you know? Where your attention goes, your energy flows, right? And then we can also use hypnosis and NLP to remove negative association links with people, places, and things, and help us to speed up linking to new associations, right? And again, the cool thing about what we do, let's say you got a current job you can't get rid of right now. You're in some, or like your family members or people you can't really cut out of your life, but you want new associates. And where you are right now, there's not a lot. Well, we know now the way your brain works, it doesn't have to be real. It could be vividly imagined. So you could start hanging out with the guys on Shark Tank. You could hang around with the Tony Robbins, the Deepak Chopras, the whoever your idols are. You could start hanging around in your mind. Why? Hey, Lisa. Hey, Wendy. If you like this, click like and share. You know, so you can get these new associations, right? Because again, we rise to the level of the people around us, right? So we want better things. Now, I promised when I did this webinar, and I was going to do it on Facebook Live, that I wouldn't sell anything. And I'm not. I'm going to give a gift. And the gift is the magic moment you can really change. And again, for on Facebook Live, which is on this camera, I will post the PowerPoints so you can get the steps later on, right? Or I will repost the other video, which will have the screens being shown. So what is the magic moment? Well, the magic moment is when you're first waking up and you come to your senses. What's happening is when you're asleep, when you're deep asleep and you first start waking up, you're coming out of that state and you're blank for a few moments. Because what's happening in your brain, melatonin, which helps you sleep, is being turned into serotonin. And then that is also boosting your body to make dopamine, which gets your butt up and gets you out of bed. Now, for most millennia, what happened when you're first waking up, the melatonin is turned to serotonin, then the dopamines, and you open your eyes. And then generally, for most of millennia, you had to get up because you had to do a threat assessment. What's going on? Am I safe? Is everything okay? Is my family fine? Is there a bear out there, a warring tribe? We don't have to do that now, so we can take our time and get up, right? If you ever get to see a video of an animal in the wild waking up, they stretch, and then they're automatically on point. That's how our brains are made, but we don't have to do that. So we wake up, And we're sitting there for a moment, and we start searching for who we are. Who am I? Right? And you know, unless you're an active alcoholic, and then you're like, where are my pants? What's going on? What is this town? You know, that's another story. Tough crowd. Lighten up, people. But you search for who you are. So you start thinking about your past. And then you may think about what you got to do today. But you think about your past. So you might go like, oh, it's Wednesday. That means I got to make a sales call on so-and-so. I hate that person. It's a pain in the ass, right? So you're using your past to overlay it on your future. And then you use your past experiences to justify the emotions that really drive you. And for most of us in our culture, it's anger, fear, resentment, things like that gets us going, you know? Because your body gets addicted to that dopamine for that rush, for that adrenaline of maybe what that negative emotion is. So you're lurking for it and you're overlaying it on today, right? And you have to begin in this magic moment to realize that your past has the only control it has on you is the energy you give it. It really doesn't have anything with who you are today. Right? The fact that whatever happened 6 years ago really doesn't, unless you keep bringing it up to yourself, right? So you don't overlay the past into the now. And you realize you have to be reborn every morning, right? And so when you're first waking up and coming to your senses, this is when you can reset your senses. This is powerful. And also to our family members, people that want, friends, family members, group people, associates that may want to hold you back, they'll say things like, come to your senses. What do you think you're doing? You better come to your senses. That boy better come to his senses. What is that saying? Well, they're really saying, come back to us. Suffer with us. You know, if you leave, what's that say about us? You know, if you quit drinking, being angry, get a better job, create a better life, whatever. If you, and so they'll say, come to your senses, which means come back to us. But when you really come to your senses, you begin to use things to reset your senses. And the biggest sense you have to set is called your reticular activating system. Because again, when you look at animals in the wild and they're first waking up, they stretch and then they go on guard. That's your reticular activating. It's looking for a threat. Well, we don't have that in our current lives most of the time, right? So what you have to do is retrain it. Right now we've retrained it like if you're ever looking for a new car and you don't know what kind of car and you go, ooh, I want to buy a Jaguar. You'll see a Jaguar everywhere. The day before you wouldn't notice it. You know, if you like a certain type of person, that's the only kind of person your brain will find, right? So that's a reticular activating system. But we can use questions to set our reticular activating system up for success. Because once you ask yourself a question, what begins to happen, your brain and mind have to solve the problem. That's what your brain is developed to do. So if you ask it a question, how can I enjoy today? How can I be a better person today? How can I be a better father, a better husband, a better, I guess people would call it, a better actor, whatever it is, better hypnotist. Your brain goes, oh, you got to do this, this. Your brain will start looking for it, right? So if you do that, if you start the day with just a couple questions, and then you mentally rehearse new responses. If you know, like, today's Wednesday, I still got the job I don't want right now. How can I respond better when Joe says his usual snarky remark? I'll blow it off. I won't even acknowledge it, you know, whatever. And I won't let it get to me, right? Then your brain goes, okay, you know. And then you ask, how can I let go of that? And your brain starts doing it. And then you spend a couple seconds, and all of this is only a few things first thing in the morning, focus on your attention, intentions, not the goal, right? So if like your current goal is to get healthy, well, a lot of us, when we start thinking about health, then we think about the illness. Oh, I got a bad knee, my bad back, I'm hurt, I got cancer, whatever it is, right? So what's the intention? I want to live a healthy life. I want to have energy. I want to move better. So if you're focusing on the intention and not the goal, per se, it kind of removes the how, right? So maybe you just get better, right? If your intention, if your goal is you want to make $1 million, it's great. But what's your intention? I want to feel free. I want to feel happy, right? So then it releases the how, right? And just say, what's my intention today? And then you do some new things. You create a new life, right? And this has the best time is that magic moment. First thing in the morning. So again, I said there's nothing to sell here, but there, I am developing a class on this to heal your mind, body, spirit, finances, and relationship. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to put it in part of the new basic NLP that I'll be teaching at the National Guild of Hypnotists in August. It's a four-day training, so 1 hour a day I'm going to spend on hypnoepigenetics, so you can learn how to program yourself for success in mind, body, spirit, finances, whatever it is you need to do. So that's going to be in the first part of August. Also, then in later August, I'm going to HypnoThoughts in beautiful Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'm teaching a four-hour addiction course, and I'm going to introduce this concept there and give some basic tips and techniques to help speed it up, and I'll tie it into addiction. That's where all of this came, for me, came from in the first place. All right? So I'll see you as we trudge the road to happy destiny. And so keep in touch. Also, too, make sure you follow me. I'll put up my follow information. It's here on Facebook. Follow me on Facebook, nfnlp.com, if you want to get on my mailing list. Twitter, it's Dr. Will, at RealNLP. Instagram, it's Dr. Will Horton. So make sure you follow me and have some fun with this, right? Because we're all in this together, okay? And let me stop the recording.